The principles of working with emotions that I'm going to teach you naturally are related to what Paramahansa Yogananda taught, and most specifically what I learned through Swami Kriyananda, because he's the one who trained me in these teachings. So I'm not making this up. It's not exactly what everyone else teaches. There are points of contradiction, because what people consider to be psychologically and egoically healthy is like the prerequisites for spiritual health. And so what I'm going to really be talking about is spiritual health, but you have to understand that the prerequisites for that is a functioning ego and a relatively well-integrated personal psychology. And if you don't have that, you have to work with the spiritual principles first to obtain that. And I say this because there's this strange quality of duality where opposites often look the same. You can see a great saint who is completely motionless, indifferent to the world, without ambition, rarely acts, may even seldom speak, sits all the time in a state of cosmic consciousness. You can see a drunk on the street who rarely acts, has no ambition, just sits on the side of the street, you know, often with his eyes closed. But he's in the most contracted state of consciousness, whereas the saint is in the most expanded. So what happens, I have observed on the spiritual path over many years, is that sometimes people who are faced with a serious necessity to create psychological and egoic health, which is to actually become conscious of their inner motivations, to have the courage to admit them and deal with them, oftentimes to have the courage to actually speak up rather than allow oneself to be oppressed, will have justified that position on the basis of cooperation, on the basis of surrender, on the basis of why should I be so self-concerned. And on the opposite end, you'll have a devotee who realizes that they're not interested anymore in just what I want. What I'm interested in now is what the divine wants, and what I want is to harmonize my self-will with divine will. But sometimes people will try to skip the whole middle. And I often find this, especially people who have adult children of alcoholics, that kind of a syndrome, or alcoholics themselves, where the personality was never developed because it was stunted by outside forces of some sort. Even if they were personally chosen, they were still outside forces like inebriation. And so they'll hope that they'll never really have to face themselves. They'll just be able to surrender themselves to God. And it's okay, because what I have observed that if that desire to be a devotee is sincere, sooner or later the force of truth pushes you back to deal with what you haven't dealt with. So you don't ever really get to escape. Now, I introduce this subject by saying that because sometimes when I start talking, either people will willfully misunderstand because it serves their, not their strengths, unfortunately, but their weaknesses, or they will become intensely upset with me for telling them to give up hard-won capacities. So that's just by way of introducing that this has to be a discussion, because some things are not self-evident. We need to make sure that we actually know what we're doing. What we have to understand to be healthy human beings and to be healthy spiritual human beings is that we have to understand who we are and what we're made of, where we're going, what is considered to be success. Because I know two of you have children in our school, and both of you who have a child in school are educators, so I think the images of children in education is going to come out in this a lot. But it's very appropriate, because the way we educate children, I mean the way Living Wisdom School educates children, the way children ought to be educated, is the way we ought to be educated, and this is something we can really see our way through. Now, with all that digression, I lost the point. So having lost the point, I'll start somewhere else now. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Ananda Village which is the First Ananda Community, which is up in Nevada City, which is a whole little society. We started our schools there 40 years ago, which tells you how many children have lived through that. You know, the people, the first graduates, are now old enough to send their own kids there, literally. But there was this one girl who, at that time, our school in the village didn't have a high school. So when high school came, the children went to the local town school. And this one girl, her name was Sandy. She'd gone all through the Ananda schools from a young child through middle school. Then she went to the school, high school, and then in the village newsletter it said that she was on the honor roll. You know, she'd been making straight A's. So I saw her and I complimented her on her making her grades, and she started laughing. She says, "It is so easy going to this school." She said, "All I have to do is give them the right answers to the test." She says, "That's all anybody asks of me." She said, "When I was at the Ananda school, I had to be in a good mood. I had to be enthusiastic about what I was doing. I had to actually be able to understand it. I had to be nice to all the other children. I had to be respectful of the teacher. I had to be honest about myself." She said, "Here, I just have to answer the test, right? And everybody thinks I'm a great student." And yeah, it was the truth. They just didn't even think about the rest of her. As Brian McSweeney put it, his father, Gary, is our middle school teacher, and Brian was a founding child of our school here. He started in kindergarten and went through eighth grade. Then he went over to St. Francis and high school. And he came back and he gave a little talk for us at one of our fundraising dinners. And his phrases were, he said, "My friends at the high school are nice. I mean, they're nice. I have good friends there," he said. But he said, "They're so unaware," was the word he kept using. He said, "They're just unaware." He said, "Where I came from and myself, the way I was raised, we're aware. We're aware of so many dimensions of ourselves and our lives. These kids are just unaware. They're just going along doing the narrow thing they're asked to do. The rest of it is just fog to them." Now, all of us pretty much were raised that way. I mean, you speak of extreme, alcoholism. You talk about the culture you came from. You know, your father was an atheist. I know a little about your family, too. I mean, we have all these different strange things. And really, none of us were brought up with a full and appropriate understanding of who we are. So that says we have to be nice to ourselves about this. The whole planet, is having a remedial cycle right now where we're trying to come in to a balanced understanding of our whole nature and how to live as human beings. We're taught in this culture how to make money, how to be personally ambitious, how to assert our egos. And if we're taught well, we're taught how to do that energetically, which doesn't mean we know nothing. But that's not the be-all and end-all. Now, there's a Sanskrit word, which I don't like to use a lot of Sanskrit because it doesn't help us, but there's a word called citta. And citta is variously translated, but one of the ways it's translated is the concept of feeling. Now, the reason I mention this is that when Swami Kriyananda talks about the sort of fundamental nature of consciousness, he emphasizes the fact that feeling is a fundamental aspect of our consciousness. And in fact, feeling is a fundamental aspect of divine consciousness. It's not just sort of dry intellectual facts. He often uses the phrase of some definition of God he heard was the cosmic ground of being. And he said, well, what are you supposed to do with the cosmic ground of being? Because what all of us are looking for, when you really stop and think about it, it's all about how we feel. What we think is useful to us because of how it makes us feel. And if we feel badly, it doesn't really make any difference what the conditions of our lives are. We think that the conditions of our lives are what we're concerned about, but what we're really concerned about is how we feel about those conditions. And when we have the right kinds of feelings, the right feeling inside, then really everything is all right. It just doesn't make any difference at all. I've always been interested in reading stories of heroic efforts by individuals, whether it's to climb Mount Everest or to live through a concentration camp or, you know, a great personal tragedy or success, but just people being able to apply themselves in very challenging situations and come out triumphant. I was intrigued. I read a book by, I think his name was Terry Anderson, if I'm not mistaken. And he was kidnapped in somewhere in the Mideast, remember?
Yes.
7 years. I think his wife was pregnant when he was kidnapped, or his daughter was small. And 7 years, and then he finally was released and came out. And one of the things he remembered when he was a journalist, when he first went into prison, is that he'd heard someone say once, if you ever find yourself in some situation like this, start writing your autobiography with this event in the past tense. And I think he later, of course, he did, you know, write a very interesting book about his experiences. But it's like, why would you do that? Because that would shift your feeling about what you're doing. And one of the reasons, now, Swami Kriyananda's, what I would call his genius as a teacher, has always been that no matter how expanded the idea, no matter how cosmic and far away from our actual experience the idea is, he always manages to take a thread of it back down and put it somewhere where every human being has touched it. So that if you can understand this, you can extrapolate from that. When I often talk to people about consciousness, I talk to them in terms of everything in life, if you really think about it, to all quote Brian McSweeney here, is about awareness. You have a little child, a little baby, and I know some of you have raised children, raising children. If you really think about it, the entire process of raising that child and educating him and her and training the child to be a better human being is a question of expanding that child's awareness. You know, little children come into kindergarten and they think that the way to get what they want is, if I want that toy, I snatch it from you and then I use it to whack you over the head so that you won't be able to come chase after me. And you have to gradually train the child to understand by expanding their awareness what the consequences of that behavior is. And you can expand their awareness both externally. I don't think you're going to have any friends if you keep doing this. You expand it externally, like, that's why he picked up the trick and whacked you in the head, is because you just whacked him in the head. So you get them to understand an awareness of cause and effect. And then you also gradually, if you have the sensitivity and the ability to, you train them to understand how different behaviors make them feel internally and get them to start using their own actual experience, which is also universal, of those actions and what kind of inner results they bring. And all of this is expanding awareness. And it goes on and on and on. You know, the child learns what a spoon is for. They learn where to put it in their mouth. I mean, the baby discovers its own toes. And then children frighten themselves by waving their own hands in front of their faces because they don't know where the hands came from. And suddenly some strange object is flashing in front of them and they have to get the awareness that this is just me and I have control over it. And if you think, yeah, the bigger the purse, the harder it is to find the phone, that's all right. As we get to be adults, it's also a case of expanding awareness. Thea, you talked about both therapy and growing up in a household where alcoholism warped things. I'm sure that your process of mental health was to become more and more aware of what was actually going on in your house and how it implicated you, how you have decided to feel because of that, and then what you can do about those feelings. And so the question then, when we talk about the possibility of self-realization, is to just ask ourselves from our present experience, is there an end point to the possibility of expanding awareness? Have any of us hit that end point? And if we haven't hit it, how far does it go? And so then we have the example of the masters who tell us literally that there is no end point. The end point is infinity. The end point is endlessness. All right. So what I'm is, feeling is the fundamental level reality of consciousness. Chitta is the substance of which we are made. And superconsciousness, God experience, is a feeling, not an idea. So the fact that we find ourselves in this life absolutely enmeshed in all of these feelings is inevitable because it's what we're made out of. And it is also the stuff through which we mold ultimately our freedom and our bliss. So it's not as if we suppress, outgrow, detach in the wrong sense. We don't stop feeling. And this is a great mistake that some spiritual people make and a lot of science fiction writers make. Science fiction writers talking about an ideal future often imagine an ideal future in which all feeling has been squozed out of life, in which we're all just machine-like characters. And evil writers, you know, have the unfeeling assassin, you know, and that somehow you just become trained to be this perfect, detached instrument. And that's somehow presented as the ultimate relationship to our feelings, is that we just don't have them anymore. But this is one of those things where you've got the opposite. Because when you really look at saints and masters, which when we start talking about human life, what you want to have is an example of someone who appears to be what you would really like to be. In my own life, I've had a long and close association with Swami Kriyananda. And through him, I've learned a great deal about what Yogananda was like. And through Swami's writings, he talks about what Yogananda was like. And what Swamiji is always demonstrating in his own life and telling us about Paramahansa Yogananda is how wonderful he was, just as a person, that he was joyful, that he was childlike, that he was humorous, that he was accepting, that he was loving, that he was kind, spontaneous, natural, enthusiastic, and just an absolute delight to be with. And certainly in my experience of Swami Kriyananda, he's just an absolute delight to be in his company. In addition to everything else that you can say, he's just tons of fun, you know, because he radiates positive feeling and a great deal of it. And Master himself was very tender-hearted. You know, his eyes would fill with tears very easily, even with all his detachment, in the sense of faith in the divine flow. I mean, true detachment, you have to understand, is not indifference. True detachment comes when you have faith in the divine flow, and that you recognize, or you're, even more than that, you are aware of the fact that we are just sort of part of this great ocean of life, and that the rising and falling of the waves, the coming in and the going out of the tides, are just the nature of what we're doing. And naturally, you know, when the wave hits the rock and the wave gets shattered, that creates a strong feeling. But if we have the sense, not that that is a good thing when it happens, but it's an inevitable part of the whole flow. And we have faith that, you know, in the end, in the depths of the ocean, everything is as it should be. That's a very different level and reason for detachment. So, as I'm saying at the beginning here, to get the principles right, we're not trying to become unfeeling. We're not trying to become cold or indifferent. We're trying to take all of that potential and really build a much bigger universe around it. So even when those waves come and go, it doesn't create for us such a tempest. I did a little bit of scuba diving in my life. I never, you know, became a real devotee, but I've done a little bit, and enough to understand, and if you've ever even done snorkeling, you know this. Wow, below the surface of the sea, there are universes going on down there. And I had seen them for a long time snorkeling, and then when we started diving, and you go way down, you know, even 30, 40 feet or deeper than that occasionally, you're just in a universe that has no relationship to the surface. You know, you're sometimes you can still look up and see the surface up there, but it's just so far away and so different than where you are now. And then there's the experience of coming back up, and you come back up a little bit slowly if you've been deeper, but then there's the point at which you break through on the surface. And when you break through on the surface, oh look, sky, people, clouds, boats, this whole world that was going on the whole time, but it didn't even exist when you were down below. And I remember once we came up and it was raining, This was somewhere in a very warm climate. And I remember just sitting there with like this, with the ocean just right at the eye line, with the little goggles on like this. And I watched the rain hit the ocean, which just in and of itself was extraordinary because it was sunny and rainy. And the drops would hit and they would explode into diamonds is what it looked like. It was so exquisitely beautiful. And there was all this happening. And then I'd just go down and it stopped. And I'd come up and it was happening. And I'd go down and it would stop. And my, there was a really interesting image there. That all of those waves keep happening. But when we're deeper, they have a whole different perspective than they do when we're right at the top and watching them all fragment. So our feeling nature is really this infinite reality that literally connects our individual consciousness with the infinite ocean of awareness. And the good news is that ocean of awareness is bliss, not suffering. But at the same time, the ocean extends all the way to the surface. And on the surface, many, many other things are happening. And those things are also an expression of our nature. But the way we relate to them depends on how much else we're aware of. I was speaking of swimming in the ocean. I think we used to travel a lot. We used to lead pilgrimage tours to India, and then we'd end up with thousands of frequent flyer miles, and then we'd use those to go someplace else. So we went to Costa Rica one year, and I was snorkeling by myself, and I was looking down, and I wasn't aware, and I got myself in a position where a wave threw me against a rock, you know, just dragged me over the rock and then dragged me back. By the grace of God, it all happened feet first instead of head first, or else I might not be sitting here talking to you. But it was a moment, you know, really to remember how powerful just those forces can be when they just catch you and scratch you up and shock you and do all of those other things in the time it takes to recover. You know, so there's a real power here that we have to think about. Okay, is there any questions or thoughts on just what I've said so far? Yes.
Going back to the head, right?
Mm-hmm. Back to that.
For me, it's hard because I know that everything is happening because God wants it to happen, and that it doesn't really matter about the hedge. But then I've increasingly, you know, become aware that we have all these, for me personally, we have all these thoughts, and really, they're not that important.
Right.
Know? And then you have all these thoughts that cause these feelings.
Right.
And so a part of me just resists, you know, having the feelings, having the thoughts, because you can have all these thoughts that really don't mean anything.
Right. But resistance does not necessarily change them.
Right. So how do you...
So that's the real question. Okay. So the beginning... Okay, let's... Okay, is there any other comments before? Because that's the rest of the conversation here. Yes.
I think the light bulb went off in my head when you said detachment is not... because that is really, to me, that was a big mystery.
Right. Okay, that's a good starting point. Okay, one light bulb.
One light bulb. You're supposed to have good feelings, though.
Yes, and we're not finished. It's 10 of 11. If it's 10 of 1 and you still have that same question, we're in trouble. Okay. But, all right, are we together? Yes.
Well,
no, go ahead. No, that's all right.
And when you said you said something like the true nature of feeling is bliss, or
right.
And one of my questions is, when I feel most connected spiritually,
right.
And it's just maybe where I am developmentally, I wouldn't say it feels like bliss. I would say it feels like this kind of exquisite combination of sadness and gratitude and
right.
happiness. And it feels like all things at one time. But what I feel like doing is crying, but it's not necessarily a bad kind of crying, although it's painful. It sort of feels like, you know, that angels weeping
right.
idea?
Right.
That's...
I think that I would say what you're feeling is a stage of
uh-huh.
it. And I think that you should listen to the masters saying, there's more.
Yeah.
And realize that you've stepped inside, you know, you've opened a door, but you haven't crossed the room yet,
yeah.
or perhaps even entered the room deeply.
Right.
But given a complicated background,
mm-hmm.
you know, standing there. So I mean, use the phrase developmentally. Okay, one of the things that I want to say here, which is very important, is You can't build a true understanding except from where you are. Because this is really about your experience. This is not about your ideas. So when we're trying to learn things with ideas, we can get lots of ideas and we can describe reality. But to describe reality is not the same as to experience reality. So one of the very delicate issues in terms of working with feelings is that we have to be both completely true to our own experience. We have to be sincere in what we're feeling. But we have to recognize the potential that's in front of us and not bring the mountaintop down to where we're standing. Mm-hmm. But say, this is how I feel now and this is what I understand is possible, and then to figure out how to route ourselves in that direction. That way, you never deny the present, but you don't elevate the present to the full potential. Right. Got it?
That makes sense.
And that's why we need the masters. Mm-hmm. You know, I've lived through a certain number of things that through my experience I really know are true. I've lived through a certain number of things that I've heard described in the spiritual texts, and therefore that gives me faith in my teachers. But there's many things they say that I am taking on faith. But as I was starting to say about Swamiji, that he can take a very big idea and bring it down to where I stand, and then I can see that the direction from my own experience. And then I don't have to just take his experience as my experience, but if this is the way, the direction it's going, and I see it as directional, then I don't really know how far it goes.
Right.
I've never taken the whole journey. If somebody on the moon tells me this is how you get to the moon, I'm going to believe them, because this is the road he's describing.
And it seems like for me there's a distinction there where it's not about saying this way is wrong.
Exactly.
This is where I am. This is
right.
True for me now.
Exactly.
And it's not all there is.
Right. Exactly. And that's awareness. Awareness. And what comes with awareness is also humility.
Right.
Humility is a really, really big word. Humility says, and humility is not self-abasement, not self-denial. Humility is just self-honesty. I know this, but I don't know that. But that doesn't mean I don't know this. I could know this extremely well, but I don't know that.
So how do we work on our resistance to, you know, what it is, right, what we're feeling? Like, so, you know, I don't want to feel this way, right? Or I don't want to be upset. So how do you work on the resistance to what it is?
I have never found it beneficial to be at war with yourself. I was at war with myself for many years of my life, and it served me not at all. The only thing it taught me is to be able to talk to other people about being at war with yourself. We worked really hard to get to this state of consciousness. We have spent millions of incarnations. You really don't even want to know how long you've been working. You know, when Jesus was being arrested to be crucified, and the prayer was, Lord, save me from this hour, was what came out of his mouth. Jesus always taught us how to pray correctly, because he would make an honest statement, Lord, save me from this hour, meaning this does not look like a lot of fun, what's about to happen. And it wasn't because he was personally concerned, he was way beyond that, but because it was a tragedy. He'd come to bring, you know, this great message of liberation, and his own people were just going to expunge him instead of accepting it. He wept for Jerusalem. I mean, we can go in the Bible for a long time, but I'll just do a little. But he said, Lord, save me from this hour. But then he corrected and he said, but for this hour was I born. Now, the way we mostly hear that is, well, he was a great avatar. He incarnated for the purpose of setting this lesson. He had to be crucified so he could be resurrected. Of course, for this hour was he born. The fact of the matter is, to sit in this room in this moment, for this hour were we born, every one of us, which is all the efforts of all our incarnations. Now, just think, we remember this one incarnation, how much we've been through, how hard we worked, how much we've strived, and think, multiply that by untold others, all of which have been this, well, you would call it the river seeking the sea. The small element of our consciousness seeking to expand its awareness on its way to infinity, and all that effort has gotten us right to here. Now, on one hand, that can be very depressing. You know, we don't want to take that as very depressing. What we want to understand about that, though, is it's a great accomplishment to be here. You know, to be conscious enough to realize that it could be better. I mean, think how many people that we know are not conscious enough to even know it could be better. That's what Brian was saying about his friends. They don't have any awareness. They're just stumbling through life without any idea of how they got here or where they're going. By the time we have enough self-awareness to know it could be better, that's a, truthfully, that's a very evolved state. And we worked very hard to get here. So there's no point in being upset about what we haven't yet accomplished. It's exactly like a first grader being terribly upset because he doesn't know his colors yet. You know, or he can't do the math problems that his older brother is doing. Or he can't play the violin without making any mistakes. That's all right. You know, just step by step, you'll go from here. And you have to help children not to be afraid, not to be angry, not to be disappointed in themselves. And that's exactly how we have to be with ourselves. It's not to say that the state we have is just fine. This is a mistake people make in trying to have self-acceptance and love themselves. As Swamiji once said, he doesn't have a lot of support for that way of thinking. He said, why should you love yourself? There's so much about you that's unlovable. He said, you're just being sensible not to love it. But to be at war with it is something different. What you want to be is aware. This is as far as I've gotten, and yes, I can get farther. So I'm going to get farther. I'm going to expand beyond this. And the best way to do it is to just not waste any energy. No, if you're a soldier in the middle of battle, you can't sort of start whining that they're shooting at me. Sergeant, they're shooting at me. Of course they're shooting at you. You have to respond appropriate now because they are shooting at you. Okay, so I have an inability to just get with the program. Okay, so I have to work with myself in just a slow, steady, convincing, persuasive way. And I have not found that being at war with myself is very persuasive.
So when you feel the resistance, you just increase your awareness.
You increase your awareness and you observe the resistance and you think, this is too bad. But more profoundly, actually, you redirect your energy. Well, you redirect your energy through a whole... It's still only 11 o'clock. But it's not that I'm trying to avoid what you're saying, but that if we understand how this works, what to do about it is obvious. The reason we don't know what to do about it is because we don't know how it works. Okay, so we're starting with the fact, which at least for Kakoli was a good thought, which is we never really stop feeling, we just become more and more refined in our feelings. And the fact that we have strong feeling natures is just the way God made us, and it's no problem. And you know, we have mostly women and one man. Men and women are very different in this. Women are born, for the most part, women are all different from each other, of course, and there's no absolute. There's feminine and masculine in the universe. And as a rule, souls in feminine bodies have a more feminine nature. Souls in masculine bodies have a more masculine nature. Not always, but generally speaking. The nature of the feminine is that it is about feeling, and it works through things through feeling. The nature of the masculine is generally that they're less interested in feelings and they're more interested in ignoring feelings and then acting in the correct way. Now, the aberration of masculine energy is that it denigrates feelings, that it refuses to relate to them, that it doesn't give them any importance. And that's why, as a rule, men are attracted to women, women are attracted to men, because they're going to balance the opposites. And as a rule, men resist what the woman has to give them, and the woman resists what the man has to give them, and that's why you can live without them. I mean, it's
that's not...
it's not smart, but we're all there. Yeah, we're all there. And I remember David taught me a very, very good lesson. Has taught me a very good lesson. You know, I've tried, like all women, to try to get him to be more like me. Gee, why not? A lot of marriage counseling have done a lot, and there was a cycle where I observed that woman after woman, because it's usually women who come at least first, came to me. Their primary complaint against their husband was that he wasn't a woman. When it really came down to it, everything about him was fine, except that he had just this annoying habit of being a man. And more than that, he didn't want to be a woman. See, that's what David taught me one day. When David just looked at me and said, essentially, you know what? I don't want to be like that. I don't even find it attractive. You know? Because I was born a man. I want to be a man. I'm not trying to be a woman. And that was like, duh. I thought, what am I, you know, like, if I really honestly care about him, I'll help him go where he's trying to go. And where he's trying to go, and who knows what he has in his background? You know, who knows what he's trying to balance in this particular case? But he became a much better woman when I stopped trying to make him one. Let's just put it that way. When I just left him alone and let him be a man. You know, men look to the horizon. Men are the sun. And the sun, it shifts. But, you know, it shifts very slowly over a very long period of time. Where women are the moon. And the moon, you know, every day it's different. Every single day it's different. You know, wax, wane, wax, wane, wax, wane, wax, wane, wax, wane. And it's always like in this little whirlwind. And men truthfully realize, and women gradually come to realize it too, if I'm going to accomplish anything, I have to be a lot more like the sun. I can't always be just jumping back in and flipping around. I have to just, yeah, I can see it happening over here. That's what David told me. He knew it was happening. He knew it was happening in himself. But he saw that it wasn't going to help him go anywhere that he wanted to go. So he would just keep his eye on the horizon and let it just play itself out. Very, very, very different completely. But not an invalid way to deal with your feelings either. It's invalid if you denigrate them, suppress them, or at war with yourself about them. But it's not invalid if you're aware with them and then choose your relationship to them. If you're incapable of feeling them, if you're afraid of feeling them, that's entirely different. But if you're conscious and make a choice, that's something else. Now, yin yang is looking for all of us, which is the, you know, the yin yang symbol is a perfect circle divided in two even halves. And that's the, you know, in all my relationships work, that is the one that I've come to like the most. It's completely non-judgmental and it's absolutely evenly divided, but both have to be in place to make the circle. And that's where whether you start in a male body or a female body, and wherever you are on the, I would say more realistically, your body influences you definitely. But it's just where you are on the spectrum of off-center, everybody needs to come to the center. Just depends which way you're going, how you're going to get there. Women tend to be way, 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 way too up and downy, and they just need to become a little more impersonal. And men can be impersonal to the point of being cold, and they need to become a little more respectful. But it never helps to be at war with yourself, which is where we started. And so to say, oh my gosh, look at me. I don't really have my entire act perfectly together. And instead of just being shocked and horrified in a state of complete dismay and absolute annoyance, see, one of the biggest problems we have is that we all want to be better, but none of us really want to heal ourselves. We just want to be rescued, which is a very, very important difference. We want to be rescued from what's troubling us. We don't actually want to say, oh, look at me. I dug with my own hands this very, very deep hole, and now I have to crawl out of it and fill it in. And that's going to take a long time, and it's going to be really boring, and it's going to have a lot of really unpleasant aspects to it, but there is no other way out because I walked myself into this. At one point in my life, I found myself way out of tune with everyone. This was my life, my whole life has really been at Ananda. So in the context of Ananda, I just got way out of tune. Way out of tune with what Ananda was doing, way out of tune with other people. I just got myself in one of these snits that people can get themselves in. And I was having a meltdown, you know, I was weeping and I was so distressed. And then just this thought came into me, honey, you got yourself into this, just get yourself out of it, you know. And it had to do a lot. I felt very alienated from people, that sort of thing. And in the course of that, I went to town to go grocery shopping. We live out in the country, and so a town trip was a really big deal. So I'm in the grocery store, and I see at the end of an aisle this family I don't really particularly like. I didn't have much in common with them, and their personalities were not attractive to me. And especially feeling the way I was feeling, I really didn't want to have anything to do with them. But I said to myself, you know, this is the attitude that got you here, which is this excessive self-concern, this unwillingness to reach out to people, this judgmental quality toward others. You know, I could see that that's what led me there. So instead of, like you can do in a grocery store, just pretending I didn't see them, I actually walked down the aisle and walked right up to them, and with great willpower, and this is part of the issue, with great willpower, I acted completely opposite to my inclination in the moment. And I just, you know, looked into their eyes, I opened my heart to them, I listened to their, what to me was boring conversation for quite some period of time. I was interested in their unattractive child. I just did everything, you know, everything that I didn't want to do. And I found it was really quite enjoyable. Because as soon as I was just entering into it, and in a very odd way, I made a bond with those people that lasts till this day. And also, I started reversing the energy. And, you know, then I had to, how do you overcome resistance? By overcoming it. I wish there was another answer. The answer is, when you feel it, you try to antidote it. And the other mistake that we can, feeling does this to us, because I'm going to make a distinction between the difference between feeling and emotion, which I'll explain in just a minute, because that's really a very important distinction. Emotion pendulums all the time. Feeling is centered, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. But when you're really in the heart of feeling, it's very, very uplifting. And when I was in the throes of emotion, my emotion was, oh, I've done this, done that, I don't like these people, I don't want to be involved, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that. That's where all your resistance is. Oh, what I was going to say is, we have this idea of extremes, that somehow, since I'm way over here, I have to do something big to solve it. But really, if you've walked way out into the desert and you've taken a wrong turn, Connie Hernandez and I went, we used to walk in the wetlands, the baylands at the end of San Antonio Avenue. Swami Kriyananda calls it the swamp. He said, that's not a park, that's a swamp. You know, he doesn't really have a great sympathy for... But anyway, so we were walking in the swamp, and we had seen these little signs. Don't ever believe the signs if you ever go to that part of the shoreline park, because it tells you, it has names like, you know, such and so loop trail. So we decided one day that maybe these were loop trails. They are not loop trails. They are dead-end trails. We walked 5 hours because we just walked ourselves out thinking, taking these big things that said loop, and then just had to accept that they were not loops, that there was simply no way back from there. And so we finally had to just accept that there was no way to get back to our car except the way we came, and we just had to turn around. It's huge. You know, we were close, but there was nothing way to get across. And it's always stayed in my mind, there's really no shortcut back. And I emphasize that because when we have this emotional response to our resistance, we think there's a shortcut back, and there isn't. And usually we overcome our resistance like a hair's width at a time. You know, and there's a tendency to prefer the dramatic gesture to the practical action. And we want a dramatic gesture that's going to detach us from everything. That's what, when I heard you talking, I was thinking about that. Oh, now I'm on the Vanaprastha stage of life. I'm going to detach myself from everything. I'm going to give away my children. I'm going to burn my wardrobe, you know? Not likely.
No.
No, but what we do is we become more relaxed when they don't call us every day, you know? Or we become... We speak to the gardener, but we don't use any swear words about the hedge. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, seriously, it's like you do better than your worst is really how you begin to walk back. The way you walk back is, I'm so enraged I could do this, but on a spectrum of 1 to 10, I'm not going to do 10, I'll only do 4, maybe 7. But I won't do 10, because then you begin to...
So if there's no outward manifestation of your upset, it's just all internal. Like, it's very, you know, I'm very cut and dry and very efficient in my interaction, but I'm all at this inside.
There's no difference. Thought is reality. So you have to, on the scale of 1 to 10, you have to do something with your thought. Okay.
And what do I do with it?
Well, action has to go somewhere. So... depending on what will work for you, you chant, you meditate, you affirm, you pray, You go to lunch with your girlfriend, you take yourself out to the movies. You know, I'm very good at taking myself out to breakfast. You know, here I am, I have a lot of work to do, I really don't want to do this work. I think better than just going back to bed, you know, or putting a DVD in the player. I think I'll take myself out to breakfast with one of Swami Kriyananda's books. Okay, that's not a 10, but it's not a 1 either. You know, it's about a 5. And maybe I'll take one of Swami's books instead of buying a newspaper, or maybe I'll buy a newspaper, so then I'm at 3, right? But I'm still not at 1, because anything that's going in the right direction is going to get you back to your goal. It took us a long time to get this confused, and it's not going to change easier. And then you realize that what's going on in my head, which you already realize, is just as dangerous as what's going out of my mouth, because what's going on in my head is going to come out of my mouth. And worse than that, what's going on in my head is how I feel. And all I ever have is how I feel.
Or is it emotion?
Well, this, let me make the distinction between feeling and emotion now, because this is really what we need to understand. Oh, okay. I'll put this image up, which will take a few minutes, and then we'll take a break. Let me just figure out how to deal with this whole thing here. There. I spoke of the fact, you know, the citta, feeling, is really a fundamental part of our nature. But as I was saying, there's a difference between the word feeling. Feeling is conscious perception with the quality of feeling. So it's neutral. It's an element of consciousness. I really feel that I'm not explaining it. I don't have the right words, but I think you all understand what I mean. Feeling is, consciousness and feeling are the same thing. Consciousness has a quality of feeling. You're not just dryly, impersonally conscious. When you're conscious, you feel. You feel either happiness or sadness or elation or... Then actually what you feel is you feel one of the 8 manifestations of God. Love, this is a whole thing in itself, but love, peace, calmness, joy, energy, light, sound, wisdom. These are the elements of consciousness. And consciousness manifests, this is a classic from the Indian scripture, the 8 manifestations of spirit, which is of consciousness, and you feel one of these at all times.
Would you say that feeling is unpredictable or emotion is unpredictable?
Emotion is unpredictable. It's exactly right. So feeling, when you're having feelings, you're reflecting these qualities, and it is taking you to the source of your being. Okay. These 8 manifestations of God, their spirit beyond these, transcending these, is the source of our being. And feeling is the link to the source of our being. Now, spirit is one reality, but it vibrates. And these are very complicated. But you can look at the world and you see it's always dual. And then it's always coming back to a state of rest eventually. You know, there's morning and there's night, there's morning and there's night. Then there's that calm point at dawn. There's that calm point at dusk. There's that calm point at noon and midnight. When just for a moment before it shifts, it goes back into stillness again. You know, we're awake and we're asleep. And then there's that sort of in-between zone. And we're children, then we're adults, then we go back to being children, and then death comes. And it's sort of all starts over again. It's this duality. It's gradually coming back to center. And our language speaks of that. You know, I feel uncentered, I need to get centered again, we often say. I feel pulled out of myself, I need to get back to myself. I feel knocked over to the side, I need to straighten up again. Because we all have a sense that we come from a source. And then in this world, when we start dividing this world up into two halves, and the way we divide it up usually is, I like it, I don't like it. This is pleasurable to me, this is painful to me. It's pleasurable to me when I'm adored by everyone in the world. It's very unpleasurable to me when people are criticizing me. It's pleasurable to me when my staff does what I want them to do. And it's very annoying to me when they don't understand and they won't do it. And so we just keep going back and forth all the time. If we ask ourselves what disturbs our feelings, what disturbs our feelings is that we're always having two sides to things. We get to one and we want it to stay, and then it always comes back. You went back to Finland. You were gathered in the home with everybody in your life that you love to say goodbye so you could come back to America. So on one hand, you had what you considered to be so pleasurable, but the circumstances of your lives just keep pushing you back and forth. The back and forthness of feeling is what emotion is. Emotion is a response off of center to one side or another. Now, again, you have to understand, it's not that you can't go there, because life inevitably causes us to go there. And this is a little bit of what you were saying, Thea. I mean, Anna Kaisa would not have not wanted to see her family in Finland. You know, to say, oh, well, I don't want to be involved in emotion, so no, I don't want anybody to come and visit me. I'll just go and look at the mountains in Finland and come home. I won't see any of you. I mean, that just, it's like you become crazy when you behave like that. But at the same time, and you wanted to feel how sort of tender and moving it is to have all those people love you. And there's a certain even poignant attractiveness to the fact that you had to say goodbye to them. And this is where what Theo was talking about. So it's not that you don't want to experience all those waves. It's that you don't want it to make you off center. And that's the difference. And here's the picture that I'll draw. And I think I can draw it over here on the side. I'll just draw it here. I have these words. I can put these words back if we need them. There's out in our community, the Ananda community there, we now live in this, the house we call Chela Bhavan, but for 18 years we lived in apartment 108 and 109. And right in front of it is this huge elm tree. I mean, the elm tree is so big you don't even really cognize how big it is. It just extends over a great deal of that green area. And in the apartments that we lived in, that tree was the defining reality of our lives. You know, it gave us a shade garden. It gave us, you know, privacy in the summer when the leaves were up. It was the view out all the windows. So I had a long relationship with that tree. Now actually I have a mulberry tree, and I have the same relationship with the mulberry. And so I thought a lot about the tree, and the tree has this huge trunk. You know, it has a huge trunk. And of course, I can't see them, but it has very, very deep roots, you know, enormous roots, because the tree goes so high and so broad, and it blows in the wind, and it's never in any danger. We had to take down a couple of very tall pines that Chidambar, who's the community manager and also an arborist, he knew that people plant those trees because they're very fast growing, but they have very shallow roots, and they began to die. And, you know, it was a big community controversy when he just cut them down because people thought he was just being crazy. In fact, part of one of them did fall on one of the apartments and, by the grace of God, didn't hurt anybody.
Their limbs become very unstable, right?
Pardon me?
Their limbs have been unstable,
and they don't have very deep roots. So they look big, but they just fall over, and if you have buildings, you don't want that. The elm is quite different than that. And the elm also has enormous numbers of branches. You know, it just goes out in all directions like this. And all those branches have all these little leaves, like that, all of it. Okay? But the heart of the tree is the trunk and the roots. And even though it goes way out to here, and there's this whole experience going out here, because, I mean, I would watch these experiences, because some of these branches reached fairly close. Now where I live with the mulberry tree, the branches are actually going right into my balcony, and I have my sleeping bed out there. So, I mean, I'm really in close relationship. I have to keep cutting them back a little because I get up from bed and they whack me in the head. But I'm in this very intimate relationship with one leaf. But when I go outside, I realize, well, good heavens, this is where the whole thing emanates from. So here's the obvious analogy. This is us. We are the trunk of the tree. You know, our roots are our relationship to the divine. This is where our life emanates from. I mean, no image is perfect, but, you know, a great deal of what makes the trunk possible is not visible to us. How did we ever get born in the first place? How can we grow up? I mean, your children are almost grown. You still have your one son at home, and, you know, Kelly's in the middle. Your little boy is very small. The oddest thing about these children is no matter what we do, they're going to grow up. Isn't it strange? I mean, I contemplate that sometimes. There's nothing we can do. And I'm sure many parents, when they have, I don't have any children of my own, but I've had a nice relationship with my nephew, who's now in his 20s, and he's grown up to be quite a big man. He was a cute little boy, and now he's a big man. I was with my sister and her husband and the nephew when we were having dinner in this restaurant, and, you know, he's not as adoringly cute as he was when he was small. And we were sitting in this restaurant with this big man who had very strong opinions of his own and was not always cooperating with our wishes about everything. And there was all these families with all these darling little boys. And I said to my sister Beth, I said, we should take him over there and say, look what's going to happen. You know, do you realize where you're going with this? And you're all going there. And there's nothing we can do to stop it. Which is to say, there's a tremendous force that we have no idea what it's about. And it has nothing to do with our opinions. And this is also, you ask about the resistance. I use the word humility. We have to have a certain humility about our own selves. You know, we know a certain amount about ourselves, but not that much. We have to stand back a little bit and not get too strongly invested into what's happening on the surface. We don't know where these roots go. We don't know what they're drawing out of. Which is to say, we don't really know God's plan. We don't necessarily know what our deepest karma is. We don't necessarily know what we're acting out in this life. And we don't even know which way is forward a lot of times. And after the next break, I'll talk about how you can tell which way is forward, because that's a really confusing issue. You know, where am I going? Where is the goal in this whole game? It's very mixed up. You know, little kids who don't know the game properly will grab the ball and run across the wrong line. Everybody thinks that's so silly, but we're doing it all the time. We're grabbing the ball and running in the direction that's not where we're supposed to go. So, but all of this from the roots, and as close as we are to the roots, as close as we are to the trunk, this is our power. And this is our bliss also. But we all know that this is our power. And we all know what makes us vulnerable is not that we have created these branches, because this tree, as I said, I think he's the guru of the whole property. He's just the guru tree. He teaches everybody how to be a tree. And he needs to do, and he's responsible for every one of these leaves. But he never makes the mistake of thinking that he is the leaf. Nor does he allow what happens to this leaf to define the experience of being himself. But he's responsible for it. And he's responsible, in fact, for making as much of this as he can. But you can also see that the more he creates it from the center with the consciousness of where his power comes from, the more beautifully he's going to be able to do it, the more appropriately he's going to be able to relate. And people's misery in life, if you watch it, is really simple. Instead of understanding themselves to be the trunk and the roots, they decide that I'm this particular leaf. Oh, look, I have this home, and I have all these nice people who live in this house with me, you know, and I have this little darling little girl who really adores me. I watched once, oh my God, at Ananda Village, there's this building up on a hill. Right now it's been turned into a temple, but at one point it was an office building, and I worked there. And there's a balcony in front, and we used to sit on that balcony and eat our lunch together. And from the balcony you could see down into the, just not that far away, but you could see down into where the central area was. And I was up there once, and you could hear the sounds. A friend of mine, his daughter at that time was about 4, just a beautiful, darling little girl. And he pulled up in his car and got out of his car. She was at least 100 yards away from him. And she saw him, and with the piercing enthusiasm of a daughter, she screamed, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy," like that, dashed those 100 yards, and then when she was at some reasonable distance, launched herself at him, and he caught her in his arms like this. Oh, my God, I thought, how could you not define your happiness from that experience? You know, how could you not? At the same time, she doesn't feel quite the same way about him now, let's just put it that way. Now that she's 37, right? So it's not that you can't do it. And it's not that he should say, you know, hello, dear. You know, He opened his arms and hugged her up as tight as she wanted him to hug her. So you do it, but you always know that this is just a leaf I'm making out here, and I'll make it as beautiful as I can, but I will not transfer my sense of self to here. Because what happens is, if you have decided that you are this branch, and then this branch breaks, then what happens is it goes right to the ground. And it happens all the time. You want your staff to behave a certain way. You get yourself invested. Your happiness is invested in them behaving that way. They don't. And so they go like this. And you have now lost your center. So your response is tiny compared to your own potential. At the same time, you've got to reach out there and you've got to relate to it. But as soon as you separate yourself from this and relate only from here, you're just working at cross purposes with yourself. So, you know, you've decided, literally, you're making a hedge. And somebody took your hedge off. Now, that hedge was probably a really nice idea, and it would have been nice not to have it hacked to bits. So the fact that it was hacked to bits can be perceived and understood on its own terms for what it is. The way to work with your emotions is not to say it's not happening. Oh, isn't it great that my daughter never calls me anymore? Of course it's not great. It's heartbreaking. You know, isn't it great that they cut down that hedge that I've been building for the last 15 years? No, it was awful. But is it my life? Or is it a leaf on the tree? I mean,
the hard thing is, I know it's not important, but yet I still have my emotions about it.
Because habitually, you have allowed yourself to become identified with leaves. Hedge is only the one right now that says, that's on the table. How do we overcome this? You practice all the time. You reference everything you enjoy and everything you don't enjoy, you reference it back to the center. You know, you refer everything to eternity and enjoy it in the moment, but give it a context. This is what I sort of say. If I hold this eraser right here, you know, and I put it here and I step all the way back, it's a black eraser, but I'm looking at it in a context. Nothing has changed. It's just as black. But when I see it in context, it doesn't dominate my reality. If I hold it right in front of my eyes, my perspective on things is really radically shifted. And so it's still black eraser. It hasn't changed. What's changed is my consciousness in relationship to it. And this is how we can be completely honest about how we feel. We can be unafraid of how we feel. We can have all the feelings that we want, and we master them not with fantasy, lies, suppression, or fear. We master them by expanding our awareness. And when we master issues by expanding our awareness, not only are we solving the issue, but we are developing ourselves in a direction that will serve us not merely in the moment, but will serve the whole reason why the tree emerged from the earth in the first place, you know, the purpose for which we were born. Now, is this simple? No. Is this like instantaneous? No. Is this the only thing worth doing? Yes. Because this really works. And everything else is a band-aid.
It's one of the interesting things about middle age, because sort of what you come to realize is life is going to take all of your limbs.
Yes, in fact.
But you will end up with no limbs.
You will end up with no limbs. Right. And that's always been, from a child, that's always been very relevant.
Right.
Astonishing to me that it's not brought into the picture more often.
Right. And the other thing that occurred to me, because I've never seen those eight words before, but yeah. I love that, is that the other thing as you age is that your ability to get in tune with the sort of the feelings of those words.
Right.
How you do that is transitory, or it feels transitory. And there's probably some truths that I don't know yet. But how I sort of get myself into that space.
Love, peace, joy, wisdom, yes.
That thing. Like, there are, it evolves, I guess, or becomes more subtle.
That is a perfect point. And that's where we need to go next, I think. But I would like to give you a break before we do that. Velvely, you had a comment, though?
We're gonna just
take that one, and we're gonna bookmark it right there because the answer is too long.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's where I get tied up, I think, a bit, is in the why. Why? You know, is it the shockers? What? You know, is it?
You mean like why do we keep getting sucked into the limbs?
Where is the why?
Okay. So the two things we need to do when we come back is why, and the other is attunement, which is what you were actually asking, Brian. Attunement with the eight manifestations. Okay? Because that is the answer to everything else that we're talking about. Once we have this picture here, the capacity to attune to these, and just to give it, just because we're here right now, it is when you have youthful energy, it's not really that we do it better, it's that we don't notice that we're not. But as youthful energy begins to wane and everything becomes more of a deliberate choice, then we become more aware of what's going on inside of us that we might not have noticed when youthful energy was masking things. And of course, when we have youthful energy to mask things, we're generally not motivated to do anything about it. And by the time the youthful energy is gone, we don't always have enough energy to do anything about it. But I don't mean that we can't. But it's one of God's horrible tricks.
Well, I was going to say, and that's when you're really willing to give it all up.
Yeah, yeah.
Take it all.
So then renunciation looks really attractive. Yeah, as Ramakrishna said once, it's not that you have renounced the world, but the world has renounced you. Okay, let's take a break. It's 11:30 according to that clock. Why don't you be back by 20 of? Bathrooms abound. There's tea and hot water and snacks outside. So... I'm ready to go on from where we were at the end of the break. Is there anything else that you thought of that we should talk about first? Thea, do you want to shut the door behind you? Okay. Okay, then let's go from here. And in fact, this is a very good place to go with this. Now, explain to me, Velvely, what the word why was about. Why do we get so confused, or why do I get so confused? What was the why?
Why do things happen the way that they do?
Oh. Is
that
the cosmic question or the personal question?
Personal question, uh-huh. Cosmic question maybe too.
Okay.
I just wonder, it just seems like there's a pattern in my life particularly that keeps repeating.
Right.
And that's the why.
Well, that was the question. That's the chakras and so on. I think I'll talk about the chakras here for a minute because I think the chakras relate also to the eight manifestations. And then there's one more fundamental concept that also has to be put up here, and I think I'll put that up first. Okay, she keeps changing her mind, doesn't she? I think she still is going to do it all, though. If we talk in general about why we were born and where we're going, it can get really lost in big ideas. Self-realization, God, you know, all these different things, the soul, the infinite. Many of us like to have a really big picture. It helps us to sort of see our little story in a big picture. But even once we have a really big picture, we're seldom actually relating to that big picture. You know, when the question on the table is seldom infinity itself, even though I was saying we should look at everything in relation to infinity, and Brian raising the question of the fact that in the end we're going to lose it all seems relevant. In fact, I was listening to a man speaking, and he talked about an exercise that he did. He was going to be a counselor for terminally ill patients, that was it. And to help him as a counselor get in tune with what the patients had to face, they were given a stack of index cards, and on it were written various things in life that are important, the meaningful work, the ability to walk, the respect of my family, a clear conscience, a nice home to live in, just all these different things. And then they played out this exercise in which one by one those cards are taken away from them. Or even it was like they had the cards in front of them and they had to give up one of them. And then he talked about how even though they were nothing but index cards, this sort of increasing feeling of desperate attachment, you know, just kept coming over to him. And when he finally was had two left, and one of them was, I think, the respect of his family or his personal integrity. And he just talked about just what a terrible crisis it became for him. You know, and all it was index cards, but he was acting out, you know, the process of death, of having to let go of everything and just live by what's in your head and nothing else. So I've often thought about that just as a by the way. Now, but what I wanted to put up here is, and there's certain premises, and I can argue for those premises or not, or just assume them, but we've talked about increasing awareness as an obvious measurement of our personal growth, our personal development, and I think that we can all more or less agree with that. So one way to think about that is that we're trying to expand our awareness. And I would say we're trying to live in a way that's expansive. We're trying to expand our consciousness. We're trying to expand our talents. We may be trying to expand our possessions. But somewhere or another, you know, we want to live in a way that's expansive, and the opposite of that would be contractive. And just these two different directions of whether an action is contractive or expansive, and this is what I was saying, which way is forward for us, is a personal application of whether this action is expansive or contractive. And I'll give you an idea of how this will work. If, for example, you are someone who, for one reason or another, was raised to believe, let's put it onto our birth families, was raised to believe that your point of view really doesn't matter. And maybe that's caused you to be a people pleaser. And you might even be respected for the fact that you can always get along. And so you think that giving up your own will, my own desires, just wanting what you want, what other people want, that's how I've gotten where I am in my life. And so to continue to do that may look like an expansive thing because it's creating this reality around you. But your motivation for doing it, your reason for doing it, may actually be because you are terrified to express your own point of view. Or that you hold the false belief that you're worthless. And of course I don't have a point of view worth speaking. So for you, the more expansive direction is to become intensely uncooperative and argumentative. And no one would think of that as being so, but for you, to be harmonious is not expansive, it's contractive. When I was 18 years old, I realized that a great deal of my agreeable nature was that I was afraid to speak out. You would not believe it looking at me now, but it was really the truth. And I just was afraid. I was afraid to have an opinion about anything. This was before I found Ananda. I was spending the summer in New York City when I realized this, which was extremely convenient. Because in New York City, it's not California, let's just say that. You know, people are just a lot more blunt. They just say what they want. And what we would consider to be incredible rudeness is just everyday life. So it was quite easy for me to become very outspoken in that atmosphere without causing tremendous chaos. So I spent the summer telling everybody around me what I really thought. You know, people cutting in front of me in the grocery line, I would point it out to them and send them to the back. And when the grocery clerk put his thumb on the, you know, the scale to just run up the price a little, I told him to get his thumb off of the scale. And, you know, just everywhere I went, I was telling people what I really thought. And it was an expansive direction for me. And then I began to enjoy it. And I began to look for ways to be angry and annoyed and to try to make people do what I wanted. And I realized it had become contractive for me because I had overcome the fear and now I was getting pleasure out of something that was not really expansive. Because to try to impose your will and to be undisciplined in your sense of appropriateness is not an expansive direction. And once it became that, I had to shift back again. There's a story told about two disciples of Ramakrishna. Ramakrishna was a great saint in the 1800s, and he lived on this temple on the bank of the River Ganges, not far from the city of Calcutta, and people often came by ferry boat, by boat to see him. one disciple was coming across on the boat, and Ramakrishna, of course, became recognized as a great master later, but during his life, a lot of people thought he was a fraud, a charlatan, all the different things that they always say about great souls during their lifetimes. And so he's coming across on the boat, and when the temple comes in sight, some of the people on the boat are very, very critical of Ramakrishna. And they start speaking about, he gets all this money, he just lives in this temple, he's a fraud, he says he's this, but he's really that. The disciple on the boat is a big, strong man. He becomes enraged, and it's a little ferry boat, and he starts rocking the boat, and he threatens to sink the ferry unless they take back what they're saying and stop right now, and he was just determined, and finally they became so frightened, they appeased him and promised to say nothing else. He gets to the dock, and Ramakrishna meets him on the dock, and he says, "What do you care what they say? How foolish of you. They're just magpies yammering. It doesn't have anything to do with you or to me. Don't behave like that. You're my representative. What will they think?" Okay, so another man is coming across on a ferry, a different disciple. And people see that and they start saying these bad things. And he just says, the man says, "Well, peace is more important than anything else." He just sits quietly like this. And they get to the dock and Ramakrishna meets him. Ramakrishna is weeping. He says, "If my own son won't defend me when people defame me, people can say cruel and heartless things and no one cares," like this. What was contractive? What was expansive? So the reality of the spiritual path is not anything external. It's that you need to do what's right for you. And that's why sometimes, when we're talking about masculine energy that's not sensitive to its feeling, it needs to become very, very sensitive. Feminine energy that can be so involved with its feelings, it needs to just not care how I feel today. It just doesn't matter. Just go on and do what I need to do, and feelings come and go. Just depends on which way you want to be. Does that make sense? Because this is everything. Is it really, and the words you're looking for, this word is freedom. And I realized when I was being nice, I wasn't being nice out of free choice. I was being nice out of compulsion. And so action that's compelled, even if it looks right, is not really expansive, because we have to actually, by our own free will, by our understanding of the rightness of the action, choose it. So if the hedge is cut down by a malicious, evil person who did it out of malice and goes around ruining people's lives, it may be necessary to sue him, right? But even if you're suing him is out of compulsion on your part, because you hate it when people do bad things, then probably it's better to let it go. And so when Sri Yukteswar's ashram were threatened by unscrupulous people, he quite impersonally filed a lawsuit to keep control of his property. Because it was an act of perfect freedom on his part. If God had taken his property away, it wouldn't have affected his happiness even slightly. It was a leaf on the tree, and he wasn't identified with it, but he was responsible for it. And to have just been too lazy to go to court would have been contractive on his part. Same actions. And just 2 days ago, I was talking to a woman in another country who for 2 years has been suing some workman over shoddy work that he did. They won, then they got it reversed, and they're doing it again. And she's talking to me about this. I said, "Why are you doing this?" I said, "In the end, it's just money, and you're going to spend more money trying to get the money. What difference does it make? Where, and you're so upset about it, and who cares?" "Oh," she said, "yeah, and there's no moral principle involved. This man's not going to learn anything. He doesn't think he's wrong. Who can say? I don't even know if he's wrong." You understand? Okay. This just gives you a blueprint. Now, then the other principle we wanted to talk about is these eight manifestations, where they come from, and I guess the chakras are a part of this. The image of the chakras, and this is just the, I'm just giving you, I'm not going to teach at great length about the chakras, but the question of why. The image of the chakras is the tree. Because the spine is the tree. The tree is a symbol of the chakras. It's hard to realize this, that everything in the material world is symbolic of a deeper reality. We think of the material world as being so huge, And the world that we can't see seems small by comparison, but in truth, everything emanates from the inside. And the reason the trees and the branches and all of that are there is because it's a symbolic representation of the chakras. This is the person, believe it or not. There he is. Okay, this is his arms. And I suppose I should put his feet down here. Okay, so then he has his feet and his legs. Okay? And we emanate from the center just like the tree does. You know, a person can exist with nothing but a torso and a head. You know, it's really interesting. In fact, there's some motivational speaker who goes around and he has a torso, he has a head, and he has a sort of like one little flipper. He has no arms, he has nothing. And he goes around especially speaking to young people. But of course, if any part of his torso were gone, and of course if his head were gone, he would be dead. It's a very interesting fact. You know, that's what can make can exist. We can look like a worm with the head, basically, but not less. Because this is the length of the chakras. This is where our life force emanates from. The base chakra is actually where the anus is. The chakras run as a tube up the center of the body, and then the body is manifested around it. So it's not the back or the front. It's not any of the physical organs. It's a plumb line from the top of the head to the base of the torso. So in the center of the body, approximately where the anus is, where the sex organs are, where the navel is, where the heart is, I'll bring his head down so it'll look better. Okay, I'm going to give him a big head here. Okay, where the throat is. And then the medulla, it's a little confusing, but the medulla is actually here, which is right here. And then the spiritual eye. And the spiritual eye and the medulla are actually opposite poles of the same chakra. Yeah, the medulla is the little curved space here. These are opposite poles of the same chakra. And I'll explain that briefly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is 6, and number 7 is at the top of the head. But the 7th chakra is only accessed through the spiritual eye. So for practical purposes, we don't really relate to it. But see, this is from the spiritual eye to the base of the spine, and without that, you can't live. Not because these are physical, but because this is the fundamental life force within us. The spiritual eye represents our complete attunement with spirit. The lowest chakra represents, this is the earth chakra. This is manifestation manifested into the spiritual world. Now, every chakra has a positive upward moving aspect and a what you would call a leak, where the energy just flows out on the level of the chakra. So the energy, people talk about the chakras being blocked. What they actually are, rather than blocked, is they leak. or the energy flows in a beautiful spiral up through the spiritual eye and then back. This is what we're really trying to do. Freedom is when the energy circulates internally and is guided by our attunement to spirit. Okay, and this is where these words come in: love, peace, calmness, joy, energy. And sometimes energy is written as power, but I find energy is easier to understand. Energy, light, sound, wisdom. I think that's all of them, isn't it? Is that 8? Okay. Now, when we manifest these qualities, we are acting in attunement with this energy. But each of these chakras also has a dimension that can be expressed, that the vibration can be expressed on a lower level. Okay, this, the heart chakra, is an obvious chakra that has to do with love. So we can either have a sense of the divine love flowing through us, which is this kind of love, which I will call prem, which is the Sanskrit word for it, or we can have the kind of love that's strongly guided by the navel, which is self-will, or the sexual desire, which is I want you because I need you, because you're going to do these things for me, with me, to me, and that has to happen, which is not exactly freedom, is it? Okay, now it's not that any of these things are bad, but they are what they are. And so when we're completely guided by divine will, all of the qualities of the chakras support this manifestation. When we are not guided by divine will, these energies flow outward at the level at which they exist. So they represent vibrations from complete self-will, selfishness, self-concern, what about me, I want, you're not doing it, the world isn't right, why did you cut down that hedge? You know, or why can't I have my whole Finnish family and my husband in America? You know, just frustration that the opposites don't reconcile. Okay, and all of those thoughts come from various levels of the chakras on their own level, because we are not able to hold to the ideal we may have that God is really doing exactly what he needs. We lack wisdom in that particular case. We may lack calmness, and as a result, we don't have joy. We're not able to hold. Now, every single time you have a thought, a feeling, an action, it's an affirmation on your part of what you believe to be real. You're answering the questions, what is real? What is real, meaning lastingly real? Who am I? And where does happiness come from? Happiness and suffering, happiness come from? What is the origin of happiness and suffering? And so, the hedge has been cut down. You have answered the question, my happiness comes from the hedge. You've also answered, who am I? I am a person who has to have a hedge. What is real is the hedge. And so all of these things have caused you to respond in a certain way. If when you looked at the hedge, you saw little molecules of light just dancing together, and you saw the little hedge as a being of light, and you saw the devas who'd gotten tired of being so big and wanted to be smaller, you know, and you saw yourself as a person who can be totally free of the necessity to have hedges, then you would have answered that completely differently. And every one of those vibrations, answers to this question, reflects a certain definition of who am I? And who am I from Christ consciousness to one body in an ego that has to satisfy itself, and the first chakra, security comes from having the world be the way I want it to be. This is the earth chakra, which is our security. Where does our security come from? Does it come from having exactly what I want in this world? The right husband, the right children, the right country, the right friends, the right this, the right that. That's what makes me secure, the right money. Or does my security come from my attunement to God and my access to these qualities regardless? And so that you, every time we answer a question, we answer that. And believe me, these are big questions. And so every time we do anything, and that's why I said thoughts are just like actions. It's a vibration of energy. There's an element here called ego, which is we have identified with it. It registers in the chakra. And the chakras are not things. Chakra means wheel. A chakra is a vibration of energy. And the thought form in the middle, whatever it is, I am attached to, I must have a hedge. It creates this energy. I am attached to Finland. I miss my family. It makes me sad not to be with my family. You know, my staff has to behave a certain way. It makes me really angry when they don't behave that way. We have a central thought form, and then energy rotates around it. And depending on how we define it, and believe me, God doesn't care what you say. You can talk a really good story. This is metaphysics. Whatever the reality of the vibration that you're expressing, it registers in the chakras. And so over the course of an incarnation, it's pennies in the bank. Every time you put a penny in, the bank begins to swell. You create lots of, they're called vrittis. This is such a mess. They're called vrittis. Vritti means a whirlpool. And you become all these vrittis in your chakras. And you can't talk your way out of it. You can't buy your way out of it. You just are. This becomes your magnetism, your aura, your energy. That's why you meet people who have either really unpleasant auras. You know, you'll just meet someone and you'll just think, oh, what a wonderful person. It's because literally their vrittis are circulating at a certain vibration, and those vrittis are generating magnetic energy, and we feel it. And if you're psychic, you see it. If you're sensitive, you can feel it with your hands. If you're a healer, you can move it around. And this is who you are. And everything else about you, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, emanates from these chakras. And when your physical body dies, you take off your body, but your chakras are still there because they're not physical. They are your astral body. And that's why in the movies now, when they die, they stand up, but they're just the same person, because nothing happens when you die, because your chakras determine who you are. Your body may die, but you don't die. And this is how it gets carried from lifetime to lifetime. Because this is not physical, but just energy, there's no limit. So we carry in our chakras not only, oh, and this is so depressing, not only everything that's ever happened in this incarnation, but everything that's ever happened in all your incarnations. That's why you meet someone. Casey has a really sweet romantic story about herself and her husband. You know, she met him like that. Just like that. You know, he's a dear person and they belong together just like that. And because the vritti was already there. And you know, now you're Casey, now he's Michael. You weren't Casey and Michael necessarily before, but the vritti was there. A very positive association with this individual. And many of us start out with very positive associations and then they don't stay so positive because there's all kinds of vrittis in here. Or the way we work with it, it comes out differently later on.
So is that your karma?
That's your karma. This is karma. And that's how karma goes from incarnation to the next. Yeah. And that's why it's metaphysical. There's just, I mean, metaphysical meaning it's physics on a higher level. And you can't cheat it. You can't get around it. It will simply express itself. And that's why it's very hard to change.
You can do your kriyas.
But, and then you do kriyas. No, that's exactly right. And then kriya, what kriya does... If you have a vritti on the side of a river, I will now actually erase some of this. This absolutely clear and fascinating illustration, I'll take it off the board. If you have a river flowing, just think now of a physical river, and there's been a whirlpool created. And there's been a whirlpool created because a log got stuck in there, and then the log attracted some leaves, and then the leaves got a rock, and then the rock got a branch. So the water can't flow. It starts to flow up and instead it gets sucked over here. Now, that's how we experience our lives a great deal, at least I do. I start out in one direction and I end up in another. How did I end up over here? I started out to say something nice and instead I said something mean. How did that happen? You know, I started out to sit down and meditate and here I am doing my emails. When did I make that decision? It's because the water was trying to flow, my energy was trying to flow this way, but there was a habit here that got sucked over to the side, like that. Now, if it's a physical river, the relationship between the flow of the river and the ability of the water to get sucked into the whirlpool depends on the relative force of these two factors, right? You can get rid of the vritti by diving into the whirlpool and attempting to move the branch and move the rock and move the leaves and move the sticks and then move the mud. And that's when you sort of go in and try to understand, why do I feel this way? And if we lack the awareness of where our experience of life is coming from, you have to do a certain amount of exploration of your vrittis. Because otherwise, you're always getting hit and you have no idea where it's coming from. And that lack of awareness is dangerous because you'll make really dumb decisions and you won't be able to tell which way is expansive and which way is contractive. Because if you don't know why you're doing things, you won't know what's happening. But the other way to get rid of these is simply to increase the flow of the river. Because when the river goes into flood, the upward moving energy or the river to the sea, It's a magnetic relationship of force against force. And when the river becomes stronger, you never have to think about it. The vritti just goes away. Now, sometimes when the vritti goes away, all the debris in the vritti hits the river and kind of knocks you like this. This is like people feeling like karmic bombs. But the only reason a karmic bomb would go off is if the upward flow of the river was stronger than what was holding that karma in place. So this is the metaphysical truth of the fact that, quote, God never sends us more than we can handle. which is that the vrittis are not released into the river until the flow of the river is strong enough to pull them up. And so the stronger we get, sometimes the more vrittis are released.
The stronger we get in...
our determination to flow to the sea. So
and psychotherapy is pulling the stick in the mud.
Yes.
In the water.
And it can be helpful, pulling out, dismantling the whirlpool.
Pulling the stick out of the
I'm so glad that, but yeah. I was just, because that's sort of like...
Yes, exactly.
Is it that's the, my intellectual understanding?
No, that's precisely true. Yeah. Psychotherapy is what is at the center of this vritti? What's at the center of this vritti? Now, at a certain point, your concentration on those vrittis in and of itself merely strengthens them.
Exactly.
And that's where psychology and spirituality divide. However, if you're a mystery to yourself and you do not know where your happiness and your unhappiness is coming from, it does help to have some idea of what those vrittis are and how they got there.
Which is how you started today.
Yes, exactly. And so you have to, that's where you have to ask the question, when does preoccupation with those vrittis become contractive, and when is it expansive? And that is a very personal question. But there is a point where the two systems divide. Okay? And so this is, and now the question is, why is it so hard? Is because we have built up all those vrittis over many incarnations. That's why it doesn't help you to be at war with yourself. You built them, and they have a certain power. And even the thought, why is this way? Oh, what a drag that it's this way. Oh, I'm so stupid for doing it. Is answering the question, who am I? What is real? And you're affirming, I am my weaknesses. I am my mistakes. I am a helpless being. Everything is horrible. And all you do is create another whole nother set of vrittis. So not only is it unpleasant, it simply makes the situation worse. Because not only do you have the fundamental problem, now you have created a whole second problem, which is that I have a problem with the problem. Bad enough, one is sufficient. So sometimes the real battle is not even the essential vritti. It's to have a very calm attitude about it. Well, of course I have karma. Who did I think I am? You know, if I was an avatar, an avatar is one who has none of these. This is why Jesus said, I was born without sin. Sin, it actually means karma. It means unlearned lessons. It's ideas of myself that are not united with the infinite. Jesus says, all of you were born with sin. I was born without sin. Although I looked for that exact phrase in the Bible and I couldn't find it. But it's because somebody said, where is that? But there's a lot close to that. But he had no karma. He was not compelled to be born. We were compelled because all these vrittis were all these desires, all these compelling energy. I want sex, I want money, I want power, I want to be a big, strong man, I want to have a son, I want to have a wife, I want to have this job. And because that's who I think I am, that's what I think is real, and that's where I think my happiness will come from. So it sucks us back in. And then we are compelled to live it out. But living it out does not bind us. What binds us is how we relate to it.
A question comes up for me about ambition.
Sure.
Because I'm a writer, and I have a lot that I want to do with that, and I haven't necessarily allowed myself full reign in doing it for a lot of reasons.
Sure.
But sometimes I ask that question about myself, like, I think I know the answer, which is that this is just something that I really, really want to do, you know, but I see my own attachment to it at the same time, and since coming to Ananda, I guess I just have questions.
No, that is a very good question. Ambition is a good way to phrase it. We don't overcome these things by just freezing and hoping that they'll go away. The way we overcome things is by increasing the flow of the river, by understanding them in context. And again, you look to the masters and you ask, how does someone live? Because even though they were born without karma, they assume the condition of human life and act out how it is to be a perfect human being. Nobody I have ever even imagined works as hard as Swami Kriyananda. I've known him for 40 years. I have I'm not certain I have ever known him to take an entire day off, meaning to not do something creative and serviceful. The day, as he was going into the hospital for open heart surgery, he was working on a book, and as he was recovering from the anesthesia, he was editing. You know, there was a deadline, it had to be met. And then he says later, he says he feels he recovered so quickly because he had to force himself just out of all of that energy. Anybody else would have said, postpone the deadline, I just had open heart surgery. So he puts forth a tremendous amount of energy. He puts forth energy because I can't do this, I'm sick, is a certain answer to who, what is real, who am I, and where does my happiness come from? Does it come from just shrinking down into myself? Now, for some people, it's contractive never to admit that I'm tired, I can't do it. And for others, it's contractive to say, I'm tired, I can't do it. It depends on who you are. You see how sensitive this becomes? But ambition is given to us by God because it will increase the flow of the river. And as it increases the flow of the river, inherently it will dissolve vrittis, or it will suck vrittis into the flow of the river where all of a sudden we know what's going on. You know, we might not have known how attached we were, poor hedge, to the hedge. Until someone cut it down. We might not have known how capable we are of anger. Right, exactly. But you were. See, that's the point. The vritti was constantly sucking energy out of your capacity to increase the flow of the river, and you didn't even know why. Because, see, it's like all of this energy that would go into essentially being governed and expressed by the spiritual eye as these qualities, instead is getting deflected. These are all the holes in the chakras. And so by the time we're here trying to do this good work with dynamic energy, we have one-third of our potential because the rest of it is keeping these whirlpools going. So when these whirlpools blow up, whether it's by death, by divorce, by bankruptcy, by an inept gardener, if we react to it, it says, oh, look, I'm not free. And it becomes tons of fun. Everything is so interesting because you're always just, it's not always enjoyable. You know, fun is a very fun, we use the word fun at Ananda a lot. You know, and fun includes the fact that, oh, look, I've been crying for 5 days because my whole life has fallen to pieces. But isn't this fun? Because I didn't know. I didn't know how vulnerable I was. I didn't know where all my energy was going. I didn't know I was capable of this. When I tried to write the book about Swami Kriyananda, which I eventually did, I have had this extremely complicated relationship with writing, which I think by the grace of God, now all I have to deal with is basic writer's procrastination, but I don't think I have such a neurotic relationship to writing as I did. I could speak and still can just effortlessly. Writing took me 3 years. After 3 years, literally 3 years, of having dropped out of teaching, told everyone I'm writing a book, I had nothing. I had not one sentence, not one usable sentence. I'd been working on it for 3 years. It was embarrassing. And it was also the most important karmic thing I've ever gone through. Everything about me came to the surface during that time. I said to Swami at the end of it, except for the fact that I really want to write this book and I have not one usable sentence, I think this has been the best period of my life. It was horrible. I was miserable start to finish. But a lot of things I just didn't know about myself came out. And I just was so helpful. It was very liberating. And in the end, I did write the book. And in the end, what what caused me to persevere? At one point, Swami said, just give up. He was playing with me. Why don't you just give up? This isn't working. And I had to stop and think. And I said, no, I'm not going to give up. I'll die trying. And the other thing was, this has been such a nightmare for me, this whole incarnation. Believe me, I do not want to do this again. You know, every job I've ever had, we'd come to the point where I had to write, and then I would just lose my center. You know, because it was just crazy. And I don't think it's true anymore. But, so that was fun. You know, it was fun, weeping morning, noon, and night. Because in the end, I gain something I really needed, freedom. Okay. Brian, were you going to say something there? Did you have a... I'm sorry, did I catch...
No, that's good. Uh-huh. I didn't know what I was going to say out loud. And we're here because we chose to play.
Again. Well, we're compelled to play. We're compelled to play. Right. And that's a form of choice because we made the choices that led to the compulsions, yes. Right. It's sort of like I joke like this. We're in the astral world, everything's fine. And then all of a sudden, you know, we want a pizza.
Yeah.
There's a little hunger for a pizza comes up, and the only place we can get it is Italy. So we find ourselves as an Italian baby, you know? How did I get here? And it's the same as like you say, you know, I'm going to spend this evening reading this book. I'm going to spend this evening doing the repairs that are needed in the house. But maybe before I do, I'll just go out and get a pizza. So we go out to get a pizza. We run into a friend. The friend's going out to a party. We go to the party. Afterwards, we go to a late movie. Then we come in and we see the tools on the counter. We never even thought about it in all that time because just some other energy just took us. And that's what happens. We can only stay in the astral world a certain amount of time because a lot of these vrittis can only be fulfilled in a material body. So after a while, they just pull us in and we get to do it again. We go for a pizza again.
Well, and aren't we sort of on the train until we get off the train? I mean, karmically speaking.
Until all of...
You can't be done until you're...
And until these vrittis are resolved. And Casey mentioned Kriya, and I never actually finished. Mm-hmm. Kriya is the supreme art of just increasing the flow of the river. And so Kriya is a way, as Yogananda writes in Autobiography of a Yogi, it just takes millions of years off of your incarnations because instead of having to act out each one of these vrittis, learn the lessons from external experience that it has to teach you, understand what it is and it isn't, we just increase the flow of the river. And every vritti that has less magnetism to hold its own position compared to the energy that we're increasing, and we just start dissolving those vrittis, and that makes us free. Because once the vrittis are gone, and what's happened is, just literally, is instead of looking at something that we desire like this, as we do more and more kriya, it backs up. And so it's still there, and you still know what it is, but you're not going to run your life over it anymore because you see. You know, yeah, it would be nice. Having a lot of money is very convenient, you know, but it's really just not worth it. And then it just goes away. And then you say, well, I still have to take care of my family. I still have to do this, but, you know, I'm not going to run my life by it anymore.
In conjunction with the practice, your discernment is expansion and contraction.
Your discernment, meaning that's how you judge.
Because how do you play?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's your measure.
That's your measure. What's expansive to my consciousness? What's contractive? And interestingly, because of thinking of you in position of leadership with the staff and so on, several different factors. One is how are things accomplished in this world? And at Ananda, Swami Kriyananda puts a tremendous amount of emphasis on harmony. It took me a long time to understand that. I am a creative artist, which is to say I have an idea and I like to manifest it. And I've learned to really appreciate everybody's contribution, but my temperamental inclination is I like my own ideas the best and I'm the most interested in just expressing them. And in fact, you know, way earlier in my life, Swamiji seriously proposed that instead of doing any of what you've seen me do, instead I just write. And one of the reasons I understand why I really needed to write, because when you write, you're in total control. And I just don't have to have anybody else's opinion when I write. And that's very satisfying to me. And not in a negative sense, it's just who I am. But nonetheless, you have to learn to work with everybody else's energy. And as Swami said it beautifully, leadership is being an artist and the medium is other people's energy. That's helped me enormously. Because I realize as a leader, it's not what you do yourself, it's how you use everybody else's energy. It's like a symphony. My husband has always been very, very good at this, and I've had to learn a tremendous amount from him. But the end point is, where was I going with that? You have to decide what's expansive for you. You know, is it expansive for me in this moment to express my creative idea because it's so self-evidently better than theirs, or is it expansive for me in this position at this point to hold my tongue because I'm really trying to do something else. And in that way, you see, now you start manifesting some of these qualities, which were over here. That's wisdom to do that instead of just manifesting energy, which I could manifest, which is also, in certain circumstances, energy is what's required. You know, there comes a point sometimes when you're the leader, where Swami puts it beautifully in his, you might look at some of Swami's writings. Swami has a book called The Art of Supportive Leadership. Small book, fantastically good book. He says, sometimes any decision short of absolute madness is better than further discussion. Because what's required then is just some energy has to move. Right. But at other times, you know, you've just got to have one more committee meeting. Because if everybody doesn't buy into it, your energy is not going to make it work. And then you have to have the calmness to actually really hold that meeting and be genuinely interested. This is where the quality of love, for example, can come in. That you're letting them have their turn. These are fabulous. You know, and then sometimes you just have to lighten up about the whole thing and just be more light. You know, be more light, shed more light on the situation, and also be more light about it. And sound is not just the om, but it's also the words that come out of your mouth and the tone of voice that they come out with, because people feel what's emanating from your chakras. You think you're fooling them, but you're not. People are very, very astute. And you think you've got them fooled, but thoughts are just as real as words. And Ananda was in lawsuits for about a dozen years, and we were sued and had to defend ourselves, and I had to have my deposition taken once. And in a deposition, your lawyer tells you, if you have a good lawyer, you answer exactly what they asked, and you answer only what they ask. And you answer the words that they have spoken. And it was amazing for me to realize when I had to sit and do that, that most of communication is vibrational and not verbal. And so somebody speaks to you, you know exactly what they asked and what they want, but you had to train yourself to hear what they actually said. And what people say, and so if you're smart and if you're clever in doing this, and if you're a bit of a wordsmith, which I was, you know, they got nothing out of me. I was just a really useless person because I could hear exactly what they asked. And once I got used to it, it was both and, because I'm also incredibly intuitive, so it was perfectly obvious what they were really asking me. But if they didn't say it, I didn't have to answer it. But that also taught me, oh, you can't fool people with your words. They feel, in that case, they feel your energy. So you really have to straighten out your energy, and you have to straighten out your energy by coming into some of these other qualities. And then everything else will follow from that. And see, when you're in these qualities, now to come to here, you know, the vrittis are created by the answer to these questions. So even if, for example, I've lost the hedge and I'm really upset, my employees are just not going to do anything that I want them to do. And my one-year plan is going to be an eight-year plan. You know, and it's just going to be. It only becomes a problem karmically when you create a vritti of annoyance about it, or frustration, or it has to be different than that. If you can create a vritti that says, okay, Divine Mother, I'm really only trying to do a good thing here. My real intention is a loving intention. And so rather than allowing myself to get sucked into the apparent, I'm going to deal with what's real. You've brought me here for a reason. It's your plan that's being unfolded. I have a job to do. I have to be energetic and wise in the pursuit of it, but I'm going to do it from the awareness of what's really happening. The medulla and the spiritual eye, the medulla is the seat of ego, which is the infinite spirit identified with this limited body. And what we need to do is we need to identify ourselves with the infinite. So we need to move our awareness from the medulla to the spiritual eye. This is the distance of the spiritual path. It's pretty short, even if you have a really big head. Because then you're answering what is real and who am I in a very different way. Where does my happiness come from? My happiness comes when I live identified with, shall we go back to the tree? With the roots from where the tree emanates and from the trunk. And when you're in the medulla, we've identified ourselves with the little leaf. And that's emotion and feeling. feeling is always in the trunk, very, very sensitive, very aware, very tender, very everything it's trying to be. Emotion is when we've just moved out onto one side and inevitably we're going to have to bounce back. And the project of life is constantly getting sucked into one side or another, and without closing our hearts, without becoming less sensitive and aware, just simply bringing our sense of self back to the center so that we can deal with all of our business from there. And no, is it easy? Oh, heavens no. Is it fascinating? Yes. And fun. And every little bit of effort you make puts a penny in the bank in the right place. And so it's a constantly evolving, and right, everything in future will improve, Sri Yukteswar said, if you're making the right effort now. The other aphorism that Ananda uses is, where there is dharma, there is victory. Dharma means right action, right? And right action means that which expands your consciousness. So if you behave in a way that is expansive for your consciousness, then victory is inevitable. And if you don't, defeat is inevitable. If not today, tomorrow, and if not tomorrow, then next lifetime. But defeat is inevitable. And the same way around. I know what I was going to say. This is the last thought, and then we'll pause for a minute here. When Swami Kriyananda was giving advice to those of us, like myself, who have positions of leadership in the various Ananda communities or aspects of the communities, he said, when making a decision, he said, it's presumptuous not to take your own spiritual welfare into account, which is a very interesting point. He said, if, for example, a situation would require that you make a very stern decision, but you can't make that stern decision without it leaving a negative residue in your own heart, he said, don't make that decision, make a different one. Because that's dharma. If it hurts your consciousness, you're planting into the situation disharmony, and that disharmony will create dissonance. No external thing is more important than consciousness. And he said, all of us, none of us are avatars. We have these positions. When somebody came and just reamed through me for a whole bunch of things I'd done wrong, which in fact I had done wrong, he was perfectly right. I just looked at him and I said, do you think if I knew how to do this job correctly, I would still be doing it? You know, it's like, of course, we're all in this together. So, of course, we're here to learn. And so we have to also be very attentive to our own consciousness. The ends do not justify the means. If it hurts us, it hurts everything. And I've found, when I am attentive to my consciousness, where there is dharma, there is victory. Because makes my magnetism correct. If my magnetism is correct, everything else works. If my magnetism is off, nothing works. I can't fool it. Okay. So, comments, thoughts, questions? We have about 25 minutes. We can take a short break if you like and then come to the end, or do you have more to ask? So, have I helped you? Are we
yes,
now?
I guess so.
It's 12:35. So, okay. Were you going to say something, Thea?
Well, my question is about Brian. Shall
he cover his ears?
I think maybe it relates to all of us.
Okay.
Like, what is dharma? And let's just say hypothetically, in a situation where a job just brings up annoyance just all the time. When does it become, that feeling is telling us that maybe we need to change what we're doing. You know what I mean?
Yes, the question is, when do you change yourself and when do you change your circumstances?
Yeah.
Master said, if you know that the test is going to defeat you, he said, the better part of wisdom is to run away from it. Because it's not good to allow yourself to be defeated too often. Because it reinforces in your mind a sense of failure. So if you really realize that this is more than I can handle, it's better just to move away from it. It also, if you know it's more than you can handle and you know that in the attempt to deal with it, in fact, you're just going to respond so badly that you're just going to create a whole bunch of vrittis for yourself that you don't want to have, then it's sometimes the better part of wisdom to just protect your consciousness and move away from it. Of course, cowardice is also not an attractive spiritual quality, and unwillingness to face difficult situations, persevere through the horrible learning curve, and emerge victorious on the other side is also a really bad idea. So it becomes a very, very delicate question as to when you should stick it through and when you should be humble enough, have enough humility to admit defeat. And there's no general answer to that. It often comes up, that you're talking about, it comes up a lot when people are talking about jobs, when people are talking about relationships, when parents are trying to save their kids, from terrible things. And questions are, you have to start, like, what is it really doing to me? The fact that it's annoying me may in itself just be a sign that I really have a lot to learn. I need to stay here. So it's a question of magnitude of annoyance. It's also a question of do I have any creative energy left? Is there a way that I can figure out that I can keep trying? Mm-hmm. Sometimes people have really tried everything and there is nothing left, and it really just is time to cut your losses and go. At other times, you know that there's more that you could do. And if you know that there's more that you could do, it's generally wiser to at least try for a while. And people have different lessons. Some people need to learn to endure, and some people need to be not to be martyrs. Some people prefer the security of the known misery because they don't have the imagination to think that life could be better. So all of it is the same. I joke with a friend of mine who has tremendous endurance. She can just endure difficult situations like I've never seen before. I have no endurance. As a result, I've taken my fault and I've made it a virtue. I am extremely creative because as soon as I don't like something, I can't stand it. I have to find a solution. So I'm always shifting things, which can make me also restless. But, sometimes for me, it's better just to endure it for a while, because I can always make something new. For my friend, she needs to think in terms of, let's think of a new solution. You don't have to just sit here like this. So it's very, very difficult to decide.
And just one thing on that, mm-hmm. is that with the ambition thing for me, I see that there's this, I do think that following that is expansive for me because I have a lot of internal prohibitions against it. And I see how I can take spiritual teachings and turn them into talking myself out of something.
Yes, exactly. That's why we need help. That's why we are a community for self-realization instead of just individuals for self-realization. Mm-hmm. We need teachers and we need each other. After decades of doing this, I do not think anybody can do it on their own. Mm-hmm. Really, nobody. Mm-hmm. You just can't, because you cannot see yourself clearly. Plus, when you start out, you can take the same words and you can twist them. They come in a certain way and they are sucked into your vrittis, and all of a sudden they look like your vrittis. And you got it all worked out, and you are dead wrong, because we just can't know ourselves. Here's another element about ambition, which is a longer discussion, but just a tiny piece. There's a certain number, as I was saying earlier, of these templates. The eight manifestations of God. This is a fantastic template. I've only just touched it here. If you go on to Ananda Palo Alto and go under the talks and newsletters, you'll find classes that I've given just on the eight manifestations and just on the chakras, because I've just brought them in tangentially here. But there's another template which is called the gunas, and I won't really explain it here. It's explained beautifully in Swami's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, the gunas. And sometimes you have to use Sanskrit because there's no English. The gunas basically says that the whole of creation is made of three kinds of energy. Tamasic energy, and again we have to just use Sanskrit. Tamas, rajas, and sattva. And what these represent, from sattva is the highest, sattva. Tamasic energy is dark, dull, lazy, fearful, inactive, I can't. Rajasic energy is just energetic. It's neutral. It can be used for destruction or creativity. It's just busy, 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 busy. The chipmunk. Sattvic energy, yeah. There's a lot of squirrels around our house. Sattvic energy is calm, uplifting, dynamic. You know, it's not dull. It's infinite in its power, but it's calm, and it's loving, and it's expansive. And we are, everything in creation, including our consciousness, is some combination of these three forces at play. Your tamasic energy makes you afraid of doing this. Your rajasic energy, which is that you just don't want to sit at home all day and watch television, pushes you to do something. And now you're trying to take your rajasic energy and use it in an uplifted way and not allow your tamasic energy to stop you. The individual spiritual battle, which is a completely internal battle, is working to overcome tamas and to direct rajas into sattvic energy. Ambition is the compelling inner force that gives us the opportunity to practice. And what you end up with, as Brian rightly points out, we die anyway and none of it stays with us, but the self-mastery of these three forces stays with you for eternity. Okay? So if you have a desire to write, try to write, because when you master, I mean, from my experience, it was tamasic energy and rajasic energy undirected. Restlessness and fear kept me from doing what I was trying to do, and 3 years of effort to break through all of those things gave me a book. But what it really gave me was, I don't want to claim it too hard, but a certain mastery over a karmic pattern that had held me for God knows how long. So therefore, to be very ambitious is often very good karma. If you express your ambition in such a way as to elevate your consciousness through doing it. But even if you express it just for self-will, it's better than being tamasic. Because if you just do nothing, it's better, as one spiritual teacher advised a man who had no energy at all. He came up to him and he said, "How can I realize God?" But he said in a very limp way. And Vivekananda was his name. He supposedly said to him, "Can you lie without being detected?" "Oh no, sir, I would never tell a lie." "Well, can you steal and get away with the things that you want and never be caught?" "Well, I would never think about doing that," the man answered. Vivekananda said, "Well, I would really like you to learn to lie so convincingly that nobody suspects, and I would like you to steal everything that you want and keep it and enjoy it." He said, "When you master those things, come back and talk to me." Now, the reason was, as Swami Kriyananda put it once, Vivekananda recognized that this man was not a good man. He was an evil man, but he was too lazy to be evil. And he needed, his rajasic energy would only be activated by doing evil things. But he needed to do those evil things because he needed to get from tamasic into rajasic. So as Swami said, the way Swami puts it, many people are not really pious, they're just too lazy to sin. But the sin is just sitting there, waiting for there to be enough energy to express itself. So it's better to be rajasic than tamasic. And if the only way you'll be rajasic is for cruel self-interest, in a bizarre way, in terms of true spirituality, it's progress. Because that action will teach you. And then you'll have the experience that will cause you to want to go higher than that. But you won't ever get that experience just sitting in tamasic energy, and you won't purify those desires by not following them. Again, it's a razor's edge. But the question is expansive, contractive. The drunk on the couch watching television would do much better to get a franchise for DDT and sell it all over the planet and become a millionaire, you know, because he would at least be expressing rajasic energy now. And this puts us, you know, in very interesting territory, which is why the spiritual path is so fascinating, because it just goes, you know, it takes simplicity, simple aphorisms, and just dumps them on the floor and stomps all over them and replaces them with fascinating dimensions that explain everything. That's been my experience. It never ceases to be interesting.
It's also great to think about the role of intellect in that, because that feels so personally true. Like, I'll hear a truth and spend 6 hours with them, and by the time I'm done, it's all screwed up. I can't hold that center, right? And then you think about what you said about religion earlier, which is sort of Mm-hmm. The knowledge predates the faces they have done. But those people are not fully realized for the most part. So of course we're going to screw it up.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
That's exactly right. And that's why, okay, now, you know, everything leads to everything. If you pick up the brochures out there that says you want to become a member of Ananda, you will find in there 12 verbs. And we've spent a lot of time in the last year trying to really understand what makes the community for self-realization, what characterizes the people in it. Many different things. One of them is participate. Because if you merely take, people come to quote, and I'll use the phrase, get Kriya. If you merely take it and go away with it, it's too subtle. And it'll get sucked into your vrittis and you won't even know it. But if you bring yourself back into relationship with the root, you know, however that happens, and for almost everyone, they need the help of a community to do it. I would say everyone. I have yet to meet anyone, and I've met thousands of people by now and know hundreds of them very well. I have yet to see it. You have to keep coming back. And then one of the verbs is attune. It's exactly like, I know Velvely is a very skilled and trained singer. I am a very mediocre singer. I can think that I've still got the melody. And then I come back and somebody else who really has the melody and it's, oops, you know, even though it sounded fine to me. But I have to come back and attune. So you have to find a way to keep tuning up again. Otherwise, you know, you have the symphony starts and everybody plays together until they're all exactly on the right note. And they do that every time they're going to play again. Because even the best, it gradually fades. You have to have a reference point that's bigger than your own ego. And
so what holds the center then?
What holds the center? Are you speaking of Ananda specifically?
Well, I'm thinking about, so in the lack of the fully realized teacher.
Oh, we have the fully realized teacher, he's just not embodied. That's where the word attuned comes. Everything in this community, and we have Swami Kriyananda, everything in the community is because individuals in this community for self-realization are all making an attempt to attune, I would call it vertically. But when you have a community of people who are all trying to attune vertically, when we stand next to each other, we begin to feel what is and what isn't attuned. Because of the power that's generated by the sincerity of everyone and the presence within the community of individuals who are better trained at attunement. Just like the choir runs better when there's somebody in the soprano section who can really hold the pitch. And when you don't have somebody somewhere in the choir who can stay on pitch, they may continue to sing the melodies, but by the end of it, they're two notes down, you know, and the whole thing has just fallen. But in the collective community, my experience of Ananda worldwide has been that very fine souls are attracted here. And Swami Kriyananda's continued presence and Master's presence and the presence of all these Masters, there's so much sincere aspiration and pure aspiration that the collective is really actually amazing. There was a woman who sat with us in our Gateway to Membership gathering a few weeks ago, and she's been around for years and has never become a member. And she has been through disillusionment. And she basically said, I've been hanging around the edges of this community for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. I keep waiting for it to prove itself false. And she says, darn, it just doesn't. You know, and the implications of that have begun to realize that she's going to have to do something about that. She says, I've met so many different people in so many different circumstances, I keep waiting for it to prove itself false, and it just won't. I said, well, I've been around longer than you, and that's the same thing I found. I didn't know when I came that it would never prove itself false. It just hasn't yet. And now I've stopped holding my breath. Because now I understand the metaphysics of it. And I see that it's not pure chance. There's a divine law. There's consciously chosen deliberate actions and systems in place, a way of functioning within the community that maintain its, you know, there's enough sopranos who can keep the pitch happening. Is that an answer? Yeah.
I have a question about this. I thought it was really fascinating that you said what Vivekananda said.
Mm-hmm.
this map, because that's where I think society and your upbringing puts you. It puts you in tamas all the time, and to get to that place which where you want to be is difficult because you have all these social norms, things you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to do it this way. You're supposed to do it this way. You know, you're supposed to live your life this way. More so, I think, perhaps if you grew up in a more traditional society, because there are lots and lots of expectations of how you live your life.
You know, I would say it's not even so much traditional as that Asian, Oriental, Indian, they're not as individualistic. Your life is defined according to the whole group, which Americans find quite quaint. Yes, anyway, we won with what you were saying. But is that...
Well, part of it is that it's very powerful.
Oh, extremely.
And, you know, if you live in this society, you can't live that way. You have to find your own way. There are no canned answers. I mean, you can go and find canned answers everywhere. But I think it is that journey, which for me has been very long and very difficult at some level. You know, not entirely. It's been fun too. But, you know, I can't say it wasn't fun, but certain decisions were difficult to make because you're leaving something that is familiar and you're venturing into something that's unfamiliar.
Exactly. Tamasic energy doesn't want to change. Right. Rajasic energy makes you restless in the middle of it. But what you also have to realize, and Brian asked this question when I had the picture of the chakras, so that's your karma? Okay, and we are born into the situations that exactly match the pattern that we've created in previous incarnations, and they match it in the way that they will give us the opportunity to expand our awareness. And they will our circumstances will challenge us in exact, you know, to the atom, to the molecule, exactly in the right proportion, because it's mathematics, it's gravitational aversions and attractions. You know, we call it God's will, but what it really is the interplay of all these magnetic forces, all of our own desires, all of our own unlearned lessons, all of the challenges that are the right size. So you being born in a traditional society, you know, means that this is your compulsion versus your freedom. This is your contractive versus your expansive. Others, either that lesson hasn't come up for them yet, or else it's not the relevant one for this incarnation, so they get to be born as an orphan. You know, they get to be born as an American orphan where there is zero on them, and that's just not their lesson. They get to learn something completely other. And this is why I was saying too, it's not good to be at war with yourself, because wherever you are is precise for you, and pretty much everybody's karma is 100% of what they can stand, whatever it is. And if it isn't, you need to be pushing the edge of the envelope a little bit.
Because, you know, there is one of the things that I find rather interesting is that because those values are so powerful, they form a real resistance against which you can,
exactly.
It's almost like you need that to develop the muscle to do other things. And so it gives you strength. It's very peculiar.
See,
I can't understand.
No, that's where the words good karma, bad karma become like really problematic. If what people would consider the worst thing in my life actually forced me to develop something that I would never have developed. My personal belief about karma, which I think is true, is it just has to get really terrible before we'll really rise to it. And so if something is really, really terrible, and then we finally, that motivates us to change, was that bad karma? You know, if we would have just drifted along in tamasic comfort unless this had happened, is that good karma? It depends on what the purpose of life is, where the goal line is. If the goal line... See, in our culture at this time, a friend of mine, Joseph Selby is the name is used. His name is Purushottama within the community. He wrote this book about the yugas, he and David Steinmetz. So this book that just came out, extremely interesting book. And it talks about how different eras, different big ages on the planet have different characteristics. We are at the beginning of Dwapara Yuga. The characteristic of Dwapara Yuga is self-interest and energy awareness. So what we're all working on right now is self-interest and energy awareness. You know, and that's just where we are. Now there was a point about that I lost. But we're born exactly where we need to be, and we're given exactly the circumstances that we need to have. And the more we can recognize the wisdom of that, and then just behave accordingly, and realize you'll get another package next time. In all of this, I forgot what I meant about the yugas. It slipped my mind. Velvet.
Well, excuse me. I see books. I'm working on balancing the chakras and this and that. So where do you start? You know, you start with chakras, or you go to Kriya, or do you do both? You know.
I think that Yogananda said you have to do 1/10 of what he taught. But everybody will take a different 1/10. That's why he taught so much. I think myself, if you feel drawn to a certain path, it's far less confusing to stay on one path than if you start adding in, if you start mixing a lot of different teachings, they often contradict each other. And they contradict each other because it depends on the perspective. If a whole group of people are south of the equator and they need to get to the center, the instructions will be to go north. And if the other people are north, their instructions will be go south. And when they meet each other, they'll declare that each other are wrong. Okay? So I think if you're drawn to one path, it helps to stay with that path. If you don't know what path you want to be on, then go shopping. You know, you want to date before you marry. You want to look around. If occasionally something outside of your tradition sparks something in you, but it's always a little, because the vrittis will suck you somewhere you don't want to go. So to me, it's a little better. I mean, it's more than a little. It's good to concentrate. And then you really, it's a circle. It's not linear. It's a circle with spokes into the center. And so anywhere you are in that circle, you're at a perfectly reasonable point. It's not like here, like it's not like this. And, you know, if your passion is healing, then you learn through healing. If you're in a financial crisis, you learn through money magnetism. If you're philosophically oriented, you read the scripture commentary. You know, it just... And then, or else you do one today and another tomorrow, and you have to just exhale and realize that we have lots of time here. It's not a big deal. And as long as on a day-to-day basis you're being helped, that's all that matters. The rest of it will fall in line. And also, no matter where you enter on the spokes on the wheel and you follow the spoke in, you're coming to where you're trying to be. And it doesn't matter if somebody else is coming from some other angle. Eventually, over the course of time, if you have an inquiring mind, you may end up going the whole circle. But if one piece of it just leads you into the center, that's enough. Fair enough. I mean, you know, some people meditate all the time. Other people are very service-oriented. Some are completely from the heart. Some are very oriented toward other people. Some are very solitary in their nature. Some want relationships. Some are monastic. Some people are creative artists, you know. Some are just simple serving devotees. You have to just be who you are. And all of it leads you to the center if you do it correctly. We have actually hit the final hour, final moment. I am perfectly willing to continue the discussion, but I honor time, so you are released without being rude. But if you're not satisfied, I don't have any other place to be but here, so I'm more than happy to continue with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope it was helpful. Very good, very good. If the subject interests you, on our Ananda Palo Alto website, as I was saying under talks, you know, over the years I've given the same subjects lots of times, and every class is different. So if you picked up, you'll see some of the same things, but if you took the same subject and listened to something else, you'd find more on the same subject that's different.
And if you'd like to listen to it in your car, they have CDs.
Yes. Thank you,
Kiss.
Yeah, yeah. Either way. Okay. Thank you all very much for coming. Very interesting. Nice to be with you all, too.